Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about vaping law changes, how to distribute the new COVID-19 vaccine in New Zealand now that pharmaceutical companies Pfizer and BioNTech said it can be up to 90% effective, and the Prime Minister's comments on Monday that there will be no changes to benefits before Christmas. But I began by asking Minister Little about the primary healthcare nurses' strikes on Monday after 10 months of negotiations over their pay. Another strike is planned in less than 2 weeks.
Well, there are discussions ongoing. I know, and having spoken to both the nurses' organisation representatives and Minister of Health officials, there is work ongoing to address the issues. Some may not be able to be addressed in the short term, but could possibly in the long term. So there is dialogue going on, and it is certainly my strong hope that we can avoid further industrial action in a couple of weeks' time.
Primary care nurses are paid 10.6% less than their DHB counterparts, maybe even lower for those who are of Māori descent. Do you think this is fair?
The reason the situation has developed the way it is because of the reasonably significant pay increase that nurses in hospitals, you know, working for DHBs, received a couple of years ago. So a gap, and there was a gap there before anyway. It has become considerably larger. The nurses who we're talking about, and indeed the medical receptionists that we're talking about, are employed by GP practices, and therefore one, or in some cases two steps removed from the DHB. Some practices are supported by, you know, through PHOs, through the DHBs, but in terms of the employment relationship, it is there's no kind of public employment relationship, although the funding might ultimately derive from a public source. This is the difficulty that we've got. And from the government's point of view, as we've seen in the past before, when additional funding has been provided for DHBs to pass on through their contracts to employers, to pass on to workers to satisfy pay settlements, actually that hasn't happened. So we have to find a solution that means that we can start to close the gap, but make sure that any additional money that goes into the system, and I'm not sure whether, you know, we've got additional money to put in at this particular point, but at whatever point we do, it's going to get to where we want it to go. This is the complexity about this particular dispute. It's not about people who are on the public payroll. It's people who are doing a job that is partly supported through public funding, and we just got to make sure that they're treated fairly and properly as well.
Right. The Ministry of Health has committed to the nurses' organisation back in September that primary care nurses will have pay parity with DHB staff. Could there be an increase of government funding for primary health organisations to resolve this matter?
I think what we've seen in the past is once the Crown passes money over, in this case to DHBs, even if we designate it for use in their contracts with PHOs and with the GP practices, we can't actually guarantee that it's going to get there. So we will do our bit, and we've got to do our bit working with the GP practices and who are represented by the Medical Association, plus the DHBs and all those involved in the chain of funding, to make sure that what happens for, you know, wages and salaries is going to be fair. Like, I think we all recognise it is unfair that a equally qualified and skilled nurse and a GP practice is paid differently from a nurse doing exercising the same skills with the same qualifications in a hospital. And that is wrong, and we'd have to find a way to close that gap. So the work is underway to do that, and I'm confident that the dialogue that is happening at the moment is constructive.
Moving on to another topic that's under the health portfolio, just yesterday, new vaping laws are now in effect. So what are the changes of this new law?
So the law prohibits the sale of vaping gear to under 18-year-olds, but obviously over 18-year-olds can purchase it. There are differences between what can be purchased from and sold from a specialist vaping store, so a store that, you know, designates itself and markets itself as selling vaping products and no doubt other things as well, compared to, for example, a dairy or a service station that can sell a much more limited range of vaping products. So the aim of the policy here is to get the balance right between not kind of encouraging young people to take up vaping as a habit, but accepting that vaping is a good step for tobacco smokers who want to kick the habit to take on their way through, you know, to becoming smoke-free. So, you know, we still have our national objective of being smoke-free by 2025. The vaping will assist, and, you know, for those who want to kick the habit, the tobacco smoking habit, to do so. So we want to leave vaping in place for that.
But are you concerned that an increase in vaping restrictions could lead some people to go back to cigarettes?
I think to the extent there's been any research on it, the advice is that it's unlikely. I mean, price is playing a huge role now in deterring people from tobacco smoking. Those who have shifted from tobacco smoking to vaping tend to stay there. And that's, you know, that's a healthier step, even though there's still some health risk associated with vaping. It's certainly healthier than staying with tobacco smoking.
The Aotearoa Vapers Community Advocacy Group has said they are concerned the legislation may further stigmatise vaping, despite it being a tool to help people kick cigarettes altogether. How would you respond to this?
I think vaping is well enough established. People who want to do it, do it. Those of us who are not smokers at all or vapers, I mean, I'm not sure I cast any aspersions on anybody who decides to do that. I think, you know, New Zealand generally allow people to make those choices. I think we made, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, we made the policy choice about wanting to heavily reduce, in fact, try to eliminate smoking at all because of the health consequences of tobacco smoking. And I think, you know, most New Zealanders sign up to that. But for those who can't kick the habit or just don't want to and are prepared to pay the price, or those who want to take up vaping, I don't think there's any stigma attached to it. In the end, this is a health initiative, and it's about trying to minimise the harm of these sorts of products and breathing in substances into your lungs other than air. That's what it's about. But if people choose to do that, and the way they, you know, people can do other health sort of risky habits, then so be it.
Moving on to the COVID-19 vaccine now, the company Vitsa has announced their type of COVID-19 vaccine is 90% effective, and New Zealand has already have an agreement to be supplied with 1.5 million doses of this vaccine. Considering 1.5 million vaccines can only supply for 750,000 people, starting with frontline border staff and people with high risk, is there a time frame that it will start rolling out in the community level other than border staff and people with high risk?
Look, it's very hard to know because we, notwithstanding the good progress that appears to be being made, and Pfizer and BioNTech, having made their announcements, it's all looking very encouraging. We've indicated that on the timetable they are talking about, there could be an uptake of the vaccine in the early part of next year. But until that happens, it's very hard to know what the rollout will look like. And obviously it makes sense. We're not going to get enough vaccines for every New Zealander, so we have to prioritise. And there will be an order of priority that will start with those who are most at risk, and those who are most at risk are those who are most likely to come into contact with the virus, and then through the rest of the population, those who were there to contract it would be, you know, their health would be most at risk. So we will have an order of priority, and then over time, we would expect as the vaccine becomes more produced and more is available, then we will have more available to import into New Zealand and to vaccinate other New Zealanders.
It's, will part of the 1.5 million vaccines that the country first received be allocated to other Pacific countries?
Not at this stage. We're aiming just looking at to see what we do with New Zealand. That is not to say that we're not working with other Pacific countries. We are working with other Pacific countries on ensuring they can get access to vaccines. I mean, if you look at countries like the Cook Islands, Samoa in particular, who are COVID-free, the urgency on them getting access to a vaccine is lower. the risk is much lower for them. That is not to say they should, they shouldn't be getting it at some appropriate time. But we will continue to work with those countries in terms of access to the vaccine. I mean, bearing in mind too, Pfizer and the BioNTech vaccine is not. It is the one that seems to be most progressed in terms of development, but it's not the only one that is under development, and it may well be that there are other vaccines become available, and not too far apart from if and when the Pfizer one is available.
Going back home, the vaccine needs to be stored under conditions that could be as low as minus 80 degrees to be effective. Does New Zealand have the existing infrastructure to support this?
Yes, we do, and it, obviously, as we've been, like many other countries, participating and then supporting the development effort, obviously we've been preparing for the possibility that a vaccine will be developed, and we can import it and store it and distribute it and manage it appropriately. So, we if and when a vaccine is properly available, then we will have the means to store it and use it.
Moving on, the Prime Minister said at the post-cabinet press conference on Monday that the government would not be raising benefits before Christmas. Considering there are tens of thousands of people who lost their jobs, food bank demand at record highs, and a huge jump in youth homelessness, and the idea of raising benefits is backed by at least 60 charities, why is that not happening?
I think it's probably more a question of timing. I think to the extent that some people are suggesting that nothing is happening, I think that is wrong. And actually, the government going back 3 years ago has a very strong track record in addressing those underlying issues of poverty, particularly income, low incomes. And that's why we did the families package. That's why the other measures we've taken in the last 3 years have boosted incomes for the lowest income earners. We know that a sole parent on a benefit is on average over $100 a week better off than they were at that time. We have a lot of work to do in terms of making sure our benefit levels are fair, but there is a cost associated with that. And at a time when we are now trying to get to grips with the long-term aftermath of COVID-19 and the deficits that we've incurred in terms of getting ourselves through that period, we are being very measured in the steps we take to address poverty and low incomes, child poverty and those sorts of things. The challenge around homelessness doesn't go away, and the need to build more accommodation, build more houses, and that is, we're well committed to that. What we do with benefit levels, we do need to make sure is sustainable long term, and it'll most likely be over a number of steps, not kind of one-offs and kind of chance payments. We want to make sure that there is a sustained pathway to increasing those levels and to reducing poverty.
Are there any plans to change benefit levels throughout the next 3 years?
We've indicated in our response to the Welfare Expert Advisory Group that we know things need to change. I mean, we put an extra $25 a week onto all main benefits earlier this year. That was in anticipation of the pressures on households going into the lockdown and COVID-19. There needs to be a longer term plan on how we address benefit levels. That work is underway. We've got the recommendations of the advisory group. We know that there are still more to be done in terms of fulfilling those recommendations, and we will continue to do that. But the circumstances have changed compared to what they were 9 or 10 months ago. And so we are taking a more measured approach.
Now, there is not going to be any benefits increase before Christmas, but would there be more government support for charities that support those in need, especially during a time where, it's Christmas?
Yeah, we have provided additional assistance to a lot of charities through the COVID-19 lockdown period and following that, because we know that that's, those who have lost their jobs, it puts huge pressure on households. I'm simply not briefed enough to know what other measures in terms of supporting those charities are happening between now and Christmas. But we do hear those, and we get the reports from those charities and consider them very seriously when we see what is happening. We will be doing everything we can, not just between now and Christmas, but well into next year and throughout this term of government to continue the work we're doing on alleviating poverty. It you know, cries out as a high priority and a critical issue we've got to get on top of, and we will continue to do so.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little. The Wire.